Thank you, Ruthie, for this song. We're going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 this morning. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. We're going to be in 1 Corinthians 13, but we're going to start in chapter 12. So that's where we're going to be. So you're stuck with me this morning. I have a simple message, but it steps on my toes more than I was expecting it to. So hopefully it does the same for you, yes? We're going to be in this book, 1 Corinthians. The book of 1 Corinthians is a harsh book. And I say that because Paul says it was a harsh book after he wrote it. In 2 Corinthians, he says, I almost was sorry that I was so mean, but then I wasn't because you fixed it all anyway. So it all worked out. But he deals with a lot of stuff because the Corinthian church was established, it was planted in a right in Greece. Corinth is right in mainland Greece. It was right in the center of secularism of its day. So Paul goes in, he plants a church, people get saved, but now they're meshing two completely different views of the world and smashing them together, and they were struggling doing that because they had a lot of their old life still embedded in a lot of their new life, and so their church just struggled with a lot of stuff. And Corinthians is interesting to read because he changes the subject a bunch of times because there's a lot of problems they had that they needed to deal with. I mean, they had gross immorality in their church. There was a guy sleeping with his father's wife, not his mother, I assume, but his stepmother. And they were like, yeah, that's fine if that's what you want to do. We're all loving here. And so they said, that's a problem. We can't be doing that. They had immorality in their own life. 1 Corinthians 6, where they were unequally yoked together and unrighteousness. They were trying to have fellowship with righteousness. And he says, you can't do that. They had bad views of marriage. He deals with that in chapter 7. They even got messed up on the resurrection. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, he has to deal with that. And so they had a lot of problems they needed to work out. But one of the biggest issues that they had was an issue that every church struggles with, which is that they were tending toward being divisive. And they divided amongst a variety of things. They divided amongst which people they liked to follow. Chapter 1, some guys liked Peter, some of them liked Paul, some of them liked Apollos. And so they ended up having factions in their church based upon which preacher they liked the most. They were divided about different standards that they had. Chapters 8, 9, and 10 is about how some people with some things from the world that they were okay with because it didn't make a difference. It's benign. It doesn't have any spiritual value at all. So you can, you know, go to the market and eat the meat. And other people said, no, it bothers my conscience and we can't have that. So they were divided over that. They were even divided amongst their social class. So in 1 Corinthians 11, he deals with the Lord's Supper. And how they would all gather together and take communion. Now, that's supposed to be an equalizing thing for our church. We all come to the foot of the cross the same. We're all people who are lost in their sins, and Jesus died for us, and we can all remember that. However, they did it a little differently, which other churches do that. In other places in the world, they do it differently, and they would do an actual dinner. They would all gather and eat a real live meal, and then they would observe this during it. And so they would all bring their food from home. But instead of being good Baptists and having a potluck where we all put our crock pot on the table and then we all go by with our plates, they all brought their own food and then ate their own food. So if they were rich, they brought a lot of food and they just brought their crock pot and put it on their own plate. And then everybody else, if you were poor, they brought less food and had less to eat. And so it was supposed to be an equalizing thing, ended up being something that caused more division of social status. And they were also, 1 Corinthians chapter 12, which is where we are this morning, they were divided because they were all different in their talents and their abilities and their spiritual gifts. And mine's more important than yours, and I'm more important for the church, and this is what we need, and not that as much. And so what Paul does in 1 Corinthians 12 is he deals with this. So I want us to read a lot of this chapter. We're going to read through it once, but I'll set it aside as we get into the message. Look at verse number 4 of 1 Corinthians 12. He says, there's diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. There's diversities of administration, but the same Lord. There's diversities of operations, but it's the same God which worketh all in all. The manifestation of the Spirit's given to every man to profit withal. For to one is given by the Spirit, the word of wisdom, To another, the word of knowledge by the same Spirit. To another, faith by the same Spirit. To another, the gifts of healing by the same Spirit. To another, the gifts, the working of miracles. To another, prophecy. Another, discerning of spirits. Another, diverse kinds of tongues. To another, interpretation of tongues. But all these work at that one and the self same Spirit, dividing to every man severally as he will. So here he talks about the diversities of abilities and gifts that the church had. And every time he talks about something, whether it's a talent, a place, an ability, or a gift, he says that ultimately, even though they're all different, they all come from the same Spirit. And so he emphasizes two things over and over again. We're all different, but we should be unified. We're all one, but we're all going to be different. And he goes back and forth between the two because both of them have to be held in tension for a church to function well. Now, here he's talking about some miraculous gifts. In the early church, when the gospel was first being preached and first being spread, the Christianity was a new way of thinking that had just begun to spring forth, and the New Testament was still being written. He allowed a lot of miraculous things to take place in the early church to validate their message and to validate that they were true followers of God. I'm not going to get into that whole thing. That's a whole other message. But the point he's trying to emphasize here is that they were very different in things they could do, and yet they came from the same Spirit. So what he does is he goes and he uses an illustration to help us understand how important this really is. So look at verse 12. His illustration is that of a body, like a real flesh and blood body. We all understand that because we all have one. So this is what he says, verse 12. For as the body is one and hath many members, and all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we're all baptized into one body, whether we be Jews or Gentiles, whether we be bond or free, and have been all made to drink into one Spirit. For the body is not one member, but many. So he's doing the same thing over and over. Your body, there's one of you. There's one of you. We refer to you as you have a name. You have one person. But you have a lot of different moving parts, and they're all very different from each other. And so he says, if the body's one member, what but many? Verse 15, if the foot shall say, because I'm not the hand, I'm not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the ear shall say, because I'm not the eye, I'm not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where were the hearing? If the whole body were hearing, where were the smelling? But now hath God set the members, every one of them, in the body as it hath pleased him. And if they were all one member, where were the body? But now are they many members, yet but one body. And so, what does that mean? The eye cannot say unto the hand, I have no need of thee. Nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. Nay, much more, those members of the body which seem to be more feeble are necessary. Those members of the body which we seem to be less honorable, upon these we bestow more abundant honor. Our uncomely parts have more abundant comeliness. For our comely parts have no need, but God hath tempered the body together, having given more abundant honor to that part which lacked. So some things are more recognized than other things. Nobody wants to look at your feet, but you are glad you walk. And the thing is, there are some things that have to be done in the church, and not everything gets recognized to the same degree. But we're all glad that it's there, that they're there. I feel so bad for the nursery workers. It's one of those things that everybody expects a ton out of them, but they're all over there, so we don't even think about them. But we would all notice the lack of nursery, wouldn't we? There's like 15 kids back there or something. Imagine putting all of them here in this front row. Everybody sit on the front row, be quiet. So much for that. So when we don't notice something, doesn't mean it's not necessary. And he reminds us of this. Why? That there be no schism in the body, but the members should have the same care one for another. So when one member suffer, all the members suffer with it. Or one member be honored, all the members rejoice with it. And ye are the body of Christ, and members in particular. He says it again for like the 10th time. He says, so God has set some in the church. He goes back to the church now. Some are apostles, secondarily prophets, thirdly teachers. And then there's miracles and healing and helps, governments, tongues. But are all apostles? Are all prophets? Are all teachers? Are all workers of miracles? Have all the gifts of healing? Do all speak with tongues? Do all interpret? But covet earnestly the best gifts. Now, in the Greek language, there's a way to ask a question and also give the answer at the same time, which is fun. We don't have that in English. We ask a question and we look at them and then we nod because that's our way of giving the answer. You can write a question in Greek and assume the answer is yes, or write a question in Greek and assume the answer is no. And here, the answers to all these questions are no. Is everybody an apostle? No. Is everybody a teacher? No. Does everybody have the same gifts as everybody else? No. Now, what's interesting is he applies this to the body of Christ, the family of God, the people in the church. The church is not a building. The church is not a social club. We use the word member. I was telling our teenagers about this. We use the word member like people use member of a country club. You go to a place, you pay dues, right? And then you expect benefits out of the club, right? And that's fine. You pay dues, and so you have the right to go up to the counter and complain that something's not working or hole number 10 was being worked on, so you had to golf past it, or the pool was broken, so you couldn't bring your kid there. So you have the right to complain that certain things aren't the way they are, and you have certain expectations that you have of the club because you give it in, so you expect out. That's how we usually treat the word church member. Well, I pay tithes here, right? I've been coming here for years. I serve in thus and so ministry, so we expect out of the church certain benefits and certain perks, like we're members of a club. That's not how God uses the word church member.
That's right.
He uses the word church member like a member of a body, where the hand doesn't say, I expect certain things out of you, head. Okay, be there for me. We're all one. We just do different things for each other's sake. He treats us as being mutually benefited and mutually responsible for one another. Now, that puts two really interesting things in tension, and it's obvious he did. Go back and read 1 Corinthians 12 again. We're one, but many, and many, but one. And then there's one of us, but there's also a bunch. And we're different, but we're still one. And he went back and forth over and over again to remind us that the church has to hold in tension that we're unified and diverse at the same time. And that is not mutually exclusive. Apparently not, because here he says it over and over and over and over and over and over again. We belong to each other. So we suffer together, we rejoice together. The church can and should have unity in diversity. But we think that you can either have one or the other. We are either unified, which means we're all exactly alike, we all think alike, we all are from the same background, we all have roughly the same ideas about all things in life, or we're diverse, which means we're bound to have division and factions and bickering about all the shared stuff that we have, the money and the interests and the facilities that we have, because we all have different views about what's important. And you can't have both. You can't be unified and be diverse at the same time. We think of it as like opposite ends of the spectrum. The more diverse we become, the less unified we are. The more unified we are, the less diverse we become. And what Jesus says is, you are not unified based upon who you are on this earth. You're unified in the fact that you all belong to me. And that's what makes you one, not all the other stuff. But Jesus does emphasize how important unity is. In his last prayer, the longest prayer that we have recorded of Jesus in John chapter 17, he even emphasizes that he's not only praying for his disciples, but for all them which shall believe on me. That's us. He says, that they may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us. Watch. That the world may believe that thou hast sent me. So the world's not going to see this as genuine unless we have something different than they have. But if we only get along with people who are like us, well, then we're no different from them. That's actually what Jesus says at the end of Matthew 5. If you love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? We have nothing different if we only are friends with people exactly like us, because everyone's friends with people exactly like them. The difference is when we can be unified about something beyond this world. In Ephesians 4, he says the same thing. I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation wherewith ye are called, with all lowliness and meekness, with long-suffering, forbearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body, one Spirit, even as you're called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. If you're real Christians, it doesn't matter what your opinions are about all the things in this world. You all serve the same God if you're a real Christian. You all got salvation from the same place, from the same way, by faith, through Christ alone. And that should be what unifies us. And so are you contributing to the unity and the diversity of the church, or are you distracting from it? But here's the problem. How in the world are you supposed to do that? And that's what he says at the end of chapter 12. Look at the very last phrase, which I did not read, and that was on purpose. Okay. He says, but I show you a more excellent way. And then he goes to 1 Corinthians 13, which is where we're going to be this morning. 1 Corinthians 13 is what many people call the love chapter. It's really easy to quote at a wedding. Many of you who have been to several weddings, especially a Christian wedding, have probably heard 1 Corinthians 13 read from the pastor who was doing the wedding. It's one of the most common verses, especially the first couple, 1 Corinthians 13, 4 and 5, one of the most common verses to frame and put in your house, right next to, and me in my house, we will serve the Lord. Right in your bathroom, you're going to have, love is patient and kind, right? Framed above the toilet. And that's because it's a very easy one to memorize, very easy one to quote. But what I want us to recognize, though, is this is ultimately about the church. And listen to me here. If I'm going to be unified with you the way that Jesus has been unified with me, which is how he says it in John 17, then I have to treat you and love you the way that Jesus loves me. That's the only way that we can be unified, be one. I mean, if somebody who is lost in the gutter of sin can be considered to be unified with the Father because of God's unconditional love for him, then that's the only way that I can actually be unified with the people around me, is if I express the same love toward them, which is what he talks about here in 1 Corinthians 13. Our problem is we're very religious, and we all know what everybody should be doing. Jonathan Swift said this, that we have just enough religion to hate each other, but not enough to love each other. We know just enough about what is right to hold everybody accountable, but not enough to actually be like Jesus towards them. God's love for us is primary. 1 John 4 tells us that if we don't love each other, we don't know God, because God is love. John 13 says that it's by our love for one another that all men will know we're his disciples. Jesus hangs all the law and the prophets on loving God and loving our neighbor as ourself. This is not an inescapable thing. And so before you go patting yourself on the back and telling yourself that you're already there, let's see how he describes love to truly be. Now, before I get into the actual part of my message, that was my introduction, I have three clarifications to the message I'm about to give. The message itself is actually not that complicated. So that's most of my message is gone about now anyway. Three clarifications to the message. Number one, the first thing that I want us to recognize is that this is about the church. 1 Corinthians 13 is about the church. Now, it's not about marriage. If you take everything I say today and you go home and you build your relationship with your spouse around this, your relationship is going to flourish, okay? Introducing the yieldedness of the Spirit and the love of God into your marriage is the only way that two people extremely different can coexist in a home, okay? So that's true. But what's going to be really easy in this chapter is to start thinking about all our other relationships. What I'm preaching about this morning is this relationship, because that's why he puts it here. How can all these people Being part of the same church family can't possibly get along if we love one another the way Christ likes us to. So I want us to put it in that mindset. The second thing I want us to recognize is that ultimately love is a fruit of the Spirit, which means I'm not really this morning saying, be more loving, because be more joyful, right? Doesn't work. We've all told ourselves to do that too. I'm just going to be happy. Well, and it doesn't. You can't just coax yourself into joy. Joy is a fruit of the Spirit. When you yield to the Spirit, He produces love, joy, and peace, and long-suffering in you. So this message is less about what to do, but maybe an indicator about how yielded to the Spirit we really are. We might be less than we like to think that we are. If our love, what we call love, doesn't actually look like what God calls love, then we might actually be loving, which means we might not be yielded to the Spirit, which means we're not going to have God's power in the church, which means we're not going to be able to do what we need to do. The last thing is a challenge for you, because it's going to be really, really, really easy to listen to this message and think about somebody else in this room. It really is, because there's other people in this room who aren't as loving as they should be. It's going to be really easy to think about me, because I walked by you one time and didn't shake your hand. Well, Brother Nathan's not as loving as he should be, and you'd be right. I'm not as loving as I ought to be. I am not as much like Jesus as I should be. But if we spend the whole time saying that other people aren't what they should be, then we've completely missed the point, because the point of loving people is loving the people around you in spite of the fact that they need to grow too. By the time we get to the end of the message, you'll see it. So my challenge to you is to do your very, very best not to ask about whether or not everybody else is perfect around you, but ask whether or not you are loving the way that God describes it to. So those are my three clarifications. And I want us to look at how God describes love in 1 Corinthians 13 this morning. So if you're a note taker, I'll try to give you the points very clearly. Number one, love cannot be substituted in the church. Love cannot be substituted in the church. Our problem as church people is not that we think love is not important. That would be a stupid thing to say. Our problem is that we often think that we can dilute the need to love one another. If we supplement the church with a lot of other stuff, we can get away with it as long as we have enough other things going on. And what he does in the first three verses is he strips us of the ability to say, well, it's okay, I don't love each other because we do this. No. So let's read each at a time. We can't substitute love with good preaching. Look at verse 1. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I become a sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. Now, most likely he's referring to possibly the fact that he used the gift of tongues, which would be being able to speak in a language he had not previously studied. So he was able to preach the gospel to people who were from a different place. And we know that God gave some of the apostles and some of these Christians the ability to do that. We see an example of that in Acts chapter 2. It labels like 9 different nationalities, all speaking different languages. Paul stands up, speaks in Aramaic, and they all understood what he said. But at the same time, we also have this instance where he gets up and he speaks great. He says, if everybody understands exactly what I'm saying, but my life doesn't have the love that it needs to have, it's noise. Now, that's really easy to apply to the pastor, and so that's a convicting thing for me. But let me shift the responsibility, based on what I said a minute ago, back to you. Maybe you love the preaching here at this church. And so you invite somebody, hey, you're going to get a good message from God's word. And that might be totally true. But when you bring somebody in here, and we have great preaching, if there's not love out there, then it still becomes noise to them. Kurt Skelly was recently preaching, and he said, when I visit a church, I don't look at how a church treats their visitors, because any church worth its salt's going to treat their visitors well. Hey, so good to have you. Here's a gift. Of course you're going to do that. He says, now I look at how you treat each other, because if I'm going to come to your church, I'm not a visitor. I'm you. And I actually sit in your pews and part of your family. The problem is not how we treat outsiders. The problem is how we treat insiders. And even if we have great things like great preaching happening from behind the pulpit, if it's not actually trickling down to the lives of those in the pews, then it's not going to go very far. You can't substitute it with great preaching. You can't substitute it with great abilities either. Look at verse 2. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so I could remove mountains, and have not charity, I'm nothing. He's talking about all the other gifts that they might have. All these other things that can help the church move forward. Remember, all the gifts are not for my benefit, it's for the church's benefits. Right. So in theory, the more gifts you had, the more the church would benefit. And he says that's a good thing. When our church has a lot that can help the church, it should be good. But if you don't have love, it doesn't profit anything. And the thing is, churches are notorious for being very busy. And so is ours. That's why announcements is like 10 and a half minutes long every Sunday morning. We got a lot going on. Every group with people that has other people that are the same age, they're going and doing something. And then we're going to have this event. We want you to come to here, and we have these programs, something your kids can be involved in. And so, if you want to come and look at the church like a brochure, what does it have to offer me? Our church is going to have plenty to do and stuff to have. But you cannot substitute love in the church by doing a lot of things that should help the church grow. All the things that we have going on does not negate the need to love one another. You can't substitute it with great preaching. Can't substitute it with great abilities. You can't substitute it with great service either. Look at verse 3. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not charity, profiteth me nothing. This is what catches most of us here, probably. Because we think that we can get away with not loving people if we do enough things. If I dig enough holes, I carry enough babies, I help in enough classes, I do enough programs, that counts, right? Because you can't love without giving. True. But you can give without loving. And here he says, I could give my life, but not love the people. Then it's not doing me any good. And for a lot of people, that's the easiest thing for us. We don't love people the way we should, but we know that we ought to, so we get involved in doing things. Now, hey, I'm all for getting involved in the church. In fact, like I said earlier, you can't really love without giving. When you love somebody, you do invest in their life. You do serve. You do sacrifice. You do give. But we could say, oh, that's what people who love people do, so if I do those things, then that counts. And it doesn't. You cannot substitute love. So not only are we probably not as loving as we think we are, but we also can't get away with sweeping it under the rug by putting in its place a lot of other good things. So now let's look and see what love really is. That is a priority in our church. I'll give you 3 points here. So this is point 2, 3, and 4. And I'll say a lot of the stuff in this passage underneath each one of them so you don't get confused. Number two, love is not self-focused. Now remember, we're talking about the church. Talk about your home, that's true for your spouse. If you're spending most of your time thinking about what they're supposed to do for you, you're going to have a very problematic relationship. Same thing with your kids, same thing at work, that's always going to be true. But we're asking about the church. Love is not self-focused. Look at verse number 4 and 5. Here's where he begins to describe it a little bit more. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Now we're gonna put that at the end. I'm going to mention that again later. So we'll just let that one sit for now. But look at the rest of this. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil. Our problem is that we are in a desperate quest to fulfill our needs and do what we want as humans. And that's not a good thing. It's funny, the disciples were different, the 12 disciples of Jesus, but they argued about a lot of stuff, various things, because they lived together, they worked together, and so obviously they had disagreements. One of the things they're caught in the Gospels arguing about several times, it's which one of them is better than the other ones. And one example in Mark chapter 9, it's a funny thing when you read the passage, Mark 9:33. He came to Capernaum, Jesus. Being in the house, he asked them, his disciples, what was it that you disputed among yourselves by the way? What an awkward question. What were you guys talking about on the way here? So what did they say? Nothing. Verse 34, they held their peace. Why didn't they want to answer his question? For by the way, they had disputed among themselves who should be the greatest? Imagine that conversation. Like, yeah, give it 10 years, though. Obviously, I'm going to be more well-known than you. Well, I understand what you're saying, but you're more likely to get thrown in prison than the rest of us, so... Probably, I mean, how does that conversation even go? They actually argued about which one of them would be the greatest. Now, remember, the disciples thought at that moment in time that the Messiah was bringing the kingdom now. So they were going to rule over the tribes of Israel. This is their thinking at this point. Obviously, I'm going to get more land. Obviously, Jesus thinks better of me than of you. Obviously, he's going to get me more responsibilities. And they argued amongst themselves. So Jesus says, if any man desire to be first, the same shall be last. This is what he's saying. You want to move forward in life. He says the worst way to do that is to put yourself first. Because the most important thing in your life is your spiritual growth, and you making yourself the priority is the worst way there. And that's not what love does, and not having love destroys a church. So what does he say? He says, love does not envy. It envieth not. If you really love somebody, you're not going to be annoyed that they benefit. Remember, when one member rejoices, all the members rejoice with it. When your hand finally gets healed and now it doesn't hurt anymore, your left ankle isn't upset that your hand's not struggling because you are feeling better. Just because your hand was the one not feeling good doesn't mean you didn't. And the thing is, when somebody is promoted, the body should rejoice. But it's only when we see ourselves as disunified from each other that we envy one another. He complains to them about envy several times, even in this book. Earlier in chapter 3, he says, you are carnal, for there is envying and strife and divisions. He says, you're carnal and walk as men. Carnal, fleshly, not spirit-filled. Now, it's interesting the word he uses, though. For envy, he uses the word zealous. It's the same word that Paul used in Galatians 1 about being very zealous for my Sunday school class, for the traditions of their fathers. It's actually strange. It's the exact same word he used at the end of chapter 12. I think it's the last verse. Covet earnestly the best gifts. It's the same word. So 2 seconds ago, he says, desire to be used by the Lord in the greatest way that he can use you. And then he says, don't envy. Well, zeal, that word for seriously desiring something, is not bad. The problem is, what is the object of your desire? When I'm seriously desiring to be used by God for the sake of other people, that's great. When I'm seriously desiring to be promoted, even at your expense, that's not loving. And some of us, our greatest desire for our church is not what we can get pour into it, but what we can get out of it. And he says we envy. He says in James 3, very strongly, ye have bitter envying and strife in your hearts. Glory not and lie not against the truth. He says, this wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensual, and devilish. He goes on, for where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. Wow. When I'm more concerned about me at your expense, he says that is devilish, and it's confusing, and it's evil. He does not mince words. Yeah, you guys should work on that. He doesn't say that. He says that ruins the church. Rather than seeing ourselves as a unified whole where I can rejoice because the body rejoices, we often become so self-focused that I only rejoice if I personally benefit. Envy. Love doesn't lift itself up above other people. Vaunteth not itself is not puffed. Loving others is to put others first. When you take advantage of your relationships with people in order to have a fan club of people around you, because it's about you somehow rising to the top, even at the expense of other people being pushed down, we're vaunting ourselves. Everybody wants to be liked. I want to be liked. I don't like when I look out into the audience and somebody looks at me with a scowl on their face like, didn't agree with that. And that's no fun. That's no fun. And we don't like that. We don't like that in church relationships either. We want to be liked. We want to be affirmed. The problem is, because we're very different, yes, you're going to disagree about something. And then the problem in churches, what happens is when there's a disagreement, then there becomes two sides. And people choose sides. And then they develop a posse of people around them on their side. And they're having a battle for prominence at the end. And regardless of whether or not you win the war, we're still approaching it with the same mindset that I'm trying to lift up myself. We're self-focused. He says it doesn't behave itself unseemly. Literally, it's like they're rude. It's the idea of that. That there's things that people expect of me, or that there's norms of what's going on around me, and I just ignore them purposefully because I don't care about what people expect of me. I don't care about what's going on. It does not behave itself unseemly. But he kind of wraps it up this way: seeketh not her own. You don't need to get your own way. Seeketh not her own. It literally means to search out a way to make things go your way. Everybody wants things to be exactly how they want them to be. Okay, you all have a bucket load of opinions, and that's fine. You all have ideas about the way things should be, about the way the music should be, and the decorations, and whatever. That's fine. And if you walked in on Sunday morning and everything in this church was exactly how you wanted it to be, you'd be happy, and I would be happy for you. The problem is not that you have ideas about the way things should go, or that you'd be happy if things went that way. The problem is where your endeavor is to make sure that everything goes your way. You seek your own. You'd be happy if things were your own, but it's when you seek my own. There's this president of a parachurch organization that does a lot of things. He was a pastor at one point. They did a survey of a lot of different churches to pastors about churches that had become more and more and more inwardly focused. They stopped going out. They stopped reaching people. They stopped doing that. And they started to survey a lot of common themes that went through all these churches that stopped worrying about other people and only worried about themselves. And one of the things that kept showing up from all these pastors is different areas of the church that they were struggling with. And it all had to do with the people in the church desperately needing things to go their way. Whether it was how the music was, whether it was how the facilities were, whether it was how the programs were, we desperately needed it for us to go our way. And see, the problem is when a whole church is surrounded by people who desperately need things to go their way, then they're not looking at other people the way that they should. And so a church filled with a bunch of individuals who are seeking their own is going to produce a church that seeks its own and not for the sake of those around them. Seeketh not her own is not easily provoked. Now, this is interesting. We read this, and somehow we manage to give ourselves a pass here. Not easily provoked. Well, I'm not easily provoked. I just get provoked sometimes. And then when they cross that line that ceases to be easily, then I am justified in being mad and lashing out. The problem is, the actual word that he uses here doesn't even really emphasize the word easily. Like, he's trying to say, like, it's super easy to be provoked. Like, you have a really short fuse. Thank you. That was the word. I was thinking of a piece of string, but had no word for it. That's not what he emphasizes. He's not saying that your fuse is really, really short. What he's saying is you don't have a fuse. You don't have a predetermined line that somebody crosses before you give yourself the license to lash out at them and say that they don't deserve your space or to disagree with them in an unchrist-like way. You don't have one of those lines. Because all of those things, whatever it is, all of these things are about me. I am the primary concern in the church. My image, my rights, my preferences, my feelings. And if you want to kill unity in the church, you don't love, and you stop loving by thinking about yourself. Love is self-focused. That was a longer one. Point two. This is point three. Love desires what is right. Love desires what is right. I'll do this point quickly because I want to get to the last one. Desires what is right. Now, it's very important that I did the last point before I did this point, because we often redefine what is right as what we want. What I want is the right thing. My preferences is truth, and we're going to earnestly contend for the faith because we're standing on the things that we just want things to be. Okay? When we're not self-focused, we'll get a good idea about what is really truth, which is what's in God's word. That's what's truth. And this is what he says next. Look what he says next. At the very end of that verse, verse 5. Thinketh no evil. Thinketh no evil. It literally means to take into account. To take into account. Oliver B. Green once said this, love, when injured, does not make a record of the injury in order to pay it back at some later time. Here's the problem. People are going to do things that are going to make you, that are going to hurt your feelings, whether they meant it or not, whether you should have responded differently or not. That's not the point. The point is that's going to happen. And we have two choices. We either are kind one to another, tenderhearted and forgiving one another as Christ forgave us, or we keep an account and hold everybody accountable to pay us back at some point. And some of them won't ever. Some of them didn't even know they had an account with you. And so then you get more mad at them because they're acting like nothing's wrong. And when we do that, we think evil of them. We're choosing not to think the best of them. We're choosing to think the worst of them. Have you ever been in a conversation before where somebody said, man, this person said this, and that made me mad, and then they did this, and oh! And then you and they were looking to you for support. They wanted you to be like, that's right, sister. I am with you. That was mean. That's what they want you to say. But you don't say that. What do you say? You say, well, you know, maybe they didn't mean it that way. They were probably thinking this. And I know they were really busy, so it just wasn't. And what you're doing is you're trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. And then they look back at you and they go, and they say, no, that's not why. I think they really meant, they refuse to allow you to give them the benefit of the doubt. Because we've already decided they don't deserve the benefit of the doubt. And so no, that's not okay. And so we choose to think the worst of them instead of think the best of them. He goes right into this, which is interesting. He says, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. We choose to think the best of people, but at the end of the day, love is always founded in truth, which, by the way, is not our preferences of what we want things to be, but is in truth. The Corinthian church struggled with this definition of love because, remember, they were openly accepting this guy who was sleeping with his father's wife and saying, this is okay, we accept you as you are. The world has redefined love as affirming your self-expression. We affirm whatever you want to be. The problem is the world is scrambling to find a line for that because the line's always moving. Because at some point, we all draw a line and say, okay, it doesn't matter you expressed yourself that way, that was wrong. But who gets to draw the line? Whoever's in charge right now. Then it always changes. And so who's actually wrong when they express themselves the way that they are? And nobody seems to know. But when we have God's word, it gives us a lot of really clear lines of this is truth. And so we're always going to stay on that. The most loving thing for people is truth and not sin. Sin is a disease. Sin is poison. And if I say that it's okay and then it destroys your life, it's my fault. I bear responsibility for calling that love. The fact is there's been people who have left churches because there was abuse and there was sin that was not taken care of. Because we were trying to just say, hey, it's okay. Love always stands on truth. But lastly, in light of all of those things, love, number four, is tolerant. Love is tolerant. So the word love has been hijacked by the world to mean affirmation of your self-expression. The word tolerant has also been hijacked by the world to simply mean this, agreement. I tolerate you by agreeing with you. So if I don't agree with you, I'm not tolerant of you, and that's hateful, so you're mean. Problem is, they don't agree with you either, so that means they're not being tolerant the other way around. The word tolerant implies two things. It implies you disagree or you find something unfavorable, and yet you choose to live well with them anyway. Both of those go together. I'm more of an introvert than an extrovert. I know that's hard to believe, but I am. I like to go home. I like to sit with a book. I like it to be perfectly silent in my house. I have an 18-month-old. So that doesn't happen ever. Before we had Levi, I was actually dreading the number of buttons that would be in my house. You know what I'm talking about? Kids come with buttons. You get toys that all have flashing buttons. They light and they sing, and there's 10 of them on every piece of plastic that you get. They give you names of letters and numbers, and they growl animal noises, and it just never stops. Sometimes they go off and you didn't touch them. Some toy settled in the toy box and landed on one of the buttons next to it, and it starts to sing in the middle of the night. So it's very loud, very noisy. Levi, he was sitting with his book yesterday, he was reading. He can't talk, he doesn't know words, but he was reading loudly and confidently all through this whole book, turning the pages, talking, but he wasn't reading any words. It's just very noisy having children. It's only going to increase the more children you have. I like silence, I have kids. So what do? I love Levi, so I tolerate noise. It implies two things. Would I rather be quiet? Sure. Of course I would. But I love Levi, so I live well with the noise. Tolerate doesn't mean, oh, it's so noisy in here, there's this child in my house. That's not tolerance. Because that's not living well with the thing that you disagree with. And wanting it to be that way and then living well with it isn't tolerance either, because there's nothing to tolerate. You like it that way. Then great. I'm glad for you. So the issue is, we don't know how to live tolerantly of each other. The world doesn't know how to say somebody's tolerant unless they just completely agree. And Christians don't know how to live tolerant with each other, because all we do is emphasize how we disagree. Yeah, that's right, I do disagree with them. I'm tolerant of all kinds of people. That's not what tolerance is. It's living well with them in spite of the fact that you don't think the same. I'm not complaining to Levi every day that his stuff is noisy, because he comes with the buttons. That's fine. I'd rather have Levi than no buttons, right? And that's our issue. We'd rather have our preferences than those people. We're not tolerant. So go to the beginning. Look at verse 4. We're almost done. Oh, man, it's so late. Verse 4. Two things, and I'll be done. It starts out that charity suffers long and is kind. It's interesting how patience sounds a lot less hard than long-suffering. You know, there's no word in the Bible that's short-suffering. The Christian ought to be short-suffering for a little while. Now, it says long-suffering. When something's difficult and you live well with it for a lengthy period of time. And look at the punctuation there. He puts kind with it. Long-suffering and kind. You endure it, and you're kind. C.S. Lewis, I was reading this a couple days ago in a chapter entitled Human Wickedness. He ended up talking about kindness, and he said, kindness is one of the easiest things to attribute to ourselves. Because it's so easy to pat ourselves on the back and say our heart was in the right place, or we wouldn't hurt a fly, even if we have never done a single self-sacrifice for a fellow creature. Well, I'm a kind person. Kindness is outward and it's active. We suffer long and we're kind to them. Our issue is that we just kind of don't hurt them, and we call it tolerance. We're not mean to them, and we call it tolerance. Charity suffers long and is kind. Now look at the last verse in that section, verse 7, we'll be done. Beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth. I believe the best for you, I hope the best for you, and I also bear everything and I endure everything. That is charity. Our issue is we don't even know how to do that with people if they don't agree with us on everything in life. I'll give you this illustration because I really want you to see it, and then I'll have to just be done. Jesus' disciples are a really interesting group of people. We just assume they're all generally the same because they all came from roughly the same area, and so they probably all thought the same. That's not true. In first century Israel, there was a whole lot of political opinions about what's going on in the world, for example, as there is in every society of mankind since then. Rome was in charge. And so you had most Israelites who were just kind of, you know, going through life, paying their taxes, grumbling under their breath, and it is what it is. And then you had people who were on the far left who were like, you know what, let's just, it is what it is, let's go along with it. Let's appease the Roman government to the extent of many of them joined them. They became tax collectors. One of the reasons people hated tax collectors was not because they cheated the system, although they did, in order to get profit out of it. But one of the biggest issues they had with tax collectors was because the Israelites saw them as deserters to Rome. Okay? The grumblers in the middle. And then you have the other side. You have the people who said, we are going to violently overthrow Rome. These are the zealots. It was their job, they thought, to train so they could raise up a militia like they did a couple hundred years ago when they overthrew Greece. We're going to do the same with Rome. So one guy's working for Rome, the other one's going to kill Rome. Matthew, the writer Matthew, was a tax collector. Simon, not Peter, the other one, was a zealot. And they were both disciples of Jesus. Imagine having 12 disciples of Jesus today. And one of them is a Republican and one of them is a Democrat. Know what our thought is? It's not possible that two people could be one in Christ and disagree on so many things. We dismiss it. But see, that just gives us an idea of how those people thought in that century. It's not possible that a tax collector and a zealot could travel in the same place and eat the same food and sleep in the same place and preach the same message. Because they weren't unified by their differences. They were unified by their oneness in Jesus. And our issue is we don't even know how to tolerate the people who disagree with us about stuff. We don't see unity with them because we think we're unified on everything else in life instead of our oneness in Christ. Jesus gave us a great example by who he gathered around him. He purposely chose people who were dramatically different, and yet somehow we forget their differences because we only see their unity. Likewise, it should be here. People forget the fact that we're different because we're just, you know, secondarily different about a lot of stuff. And we can have conversations and opinions, and maybe somebody is right. But to tolerate each other is to recognize that I very much disagree with you, but I love you because you're my brother. And therefore, I'm long-suffering and I'm kind. That's what love is, and that's what brings unity. And that's why he puts it here after all the chapters of disagreement in the church, because you cannot separate the one from the other. He has so many illustrations of unity in the church throughout the Bible. We are branches all attached to the same vine. We're stones all living, built together into one house on the same cornerstone. We are all members of the same nation with one king, 1 Peter 2. We are all family. We are all sheep led by the same shepherd. We are all a body with the same head. And so we're all going to be very different about a lot of things. We're all going to disagree with each other about various things. But the church is not a social club to gather around people exactly like you. But it's a unity of different people who have all been made one in Christ. And in order for that to be what it needs to be, in order to be different than every single group of people out there, then we have to love one another, or else we have nothing.